while still possibly licking wounds, unhealed from his careless life experiences. Moody, the dates in her autobiography and the date of its publication, 1968, indicate, composed prayers a few years after graduation from college at the age of 28. The evidence, I think, is that her wounds were also still inflamed, bolstered perhaps both by his relatively greater distance from his earlier experiences, by his intervening Chicago experience, and by having already confronted many of his own ideas in the process of writing up Tom's Children. In other words, Wright renders a feeling of deeper self-criticism, a greater reflection of the meaning of others' existence, and more imposing portraits. Wright, of course, is not perfect in such renderings, but we do get the advantage of a technique which alternates dramatizing the immediacy of experience with registration of reflections and judgments of the now mature personality. Ultimately, despite some similarities in the autobiographical territories and rebellious personalities, one senses important differences. And Moody's Mississippi is not quite the self-contained Southern unit which Wright's could pretend to be. Only the more advanced white personalities, such as William Faulkner, could sense that World War I's impact forecast the crumbling of the major props undergirding the Mississippi and Southern way of life. As late as 1930, even many of these more advanced personalities could still find it viable to debate the South's choices, as strikingly evidenced by such a work as I'll Take My Stand, The South in Their Various Conditions by 12 Southerners, such Southerners as Donald Davidson, John Drew Fletcher, N.D. Klein, Lawless, Cornelia, Stark, Young, Helen Tate, John Crow Ransom, Robert Penn Warren, and others. On the other hand, Anne Moody's South has faced not only World War II, but during her coming of age, it's had to stare at the implications of the 1954 Supreme Court decision outlawing public school segregation. Despite the Southern cries of never, the very frenzy of the Southern defensive and offensive activity after that court decision announced the secure presence of the rhythms of uncertainty. One notices that in domestic work and encounters among whites, several faces, the nervous and racially reactionary emotions of her white employee, Mrs. Burke, the unselfconscious and kind paternalism of the Clybornes, a first name relationship with a young employer, Linda Jean, a temporary relationship of equality among a small group of white students whom she tutors. Such variety would not have been available to write. Such faces distinguish her situation from that of Richard Wright's, although it should be clear that the traditional face of race relations is still vicious. Most white men have a black woman on the side, or at times in an open common law status. Young black women are directly confronted on the streets. The black male is subjected to violence, destroyed unless he is lucky enough to escape or association with a white woman. On a personal level, Anne's resources are greater than those of Wright's, her early resources. Partly because she's a woman with that traditional flexibility in the South, but also because of a combination of qualities which gives her a secure sense of self-possession and status and institutional support. Although the church finally disgusts her, the schools are avenues of personal expression which welcomes what she can bring, her brightness, prettiness, athletic skills, leadership. In other words, she profits by the unconventional channels offered by the schools, although friction results from the attractiveness that temporarily causes one of the athletic coaches to become too aware of her flowering womanhood. And from grade and athletic competition, and in college, from her leadership confronting the vagaries of school administrations. Security and the possession of these personal qualities made her passionately single-minded as a rebel, and though hurt very deeply by conflicts, seldom a person of inner confusion about herself or the people and situations against which she must revolt. As she comes to consciousness in the larger world, her qualities and experiences find a ready place in a young black generation of Mississippians who are defining themselves through their rejection of old black and white ways. The lynching of young 14-year-old boy Emmett Till arouses an anger within her male fellow students in high school. Quote, "Look at all these white men here that's talking about women. Everybody knows the truth, and what's done about that? Look how many white babies we got walking around our neighborhood. And my mama ain't white meat either. That boy was from Chicago. Shit, everybody talk everybody up there. He probably didn't even think of the bitch was white." Moody says, "What they were talking, what they were saying shocked me. I knew all of those boys, and I had never heard them talk like that. We walked on behind them for a while listening. Questions about who was killed, where, and why started running through my mind. I walked up to one of the boys. Eddie, what boy was killed? The boy rebukes her for not knowing anything but her books. She had to work after school and spend her lunch hours doing the lesson. Actor had deprived her of the goal-setting knowledge provided by the consciousnesses of young friends. Quote, and you were never told anything by adults." Unquote. When she gets home to question her mother, Moody finds her retreating into religion, invasion, angry responses to inquiries, and advocacy of the usual survival tactics. Quote, "You go on to work before you advance. And don't you let on like you know nothing about that boy being killed before Mr. Burke did. Just do your work like you don't know nothing. That boy is a lot better off in heaven than he is here." Unquote. The mother goes back to singing, presumably the song she was singing when Ann entered the house. "I got shoes, you got shoes, all of our children got shoes. When I get to heaven, I'm going to put on my shoes. I'm going to pop all over God's head. When I get to heaven, I'm going to put on my shoes. I'm going to walk all over God's head." Mrs. Bryce, a black school teacher, becomes a surrogate mother, answers the pressing questions, but is mysteriously fired from her school position at the end of the year. At the age of 15, Anne begins a long period of anger and frustration, which reaches different peaks and powers in various parts of the world. I was 15 years old when I began to hate people. I hated the white man who murdered Emmett Till, and I hated the other whites who were responsible for countless murders Mrs. Wright had told me about, and those I vaguely remembered from childhood. I also hated Negroes. I hated them for not standing up and doing something about the murders. In fact, I think I had a stronger resentment toward Negroes for letting the whites kill them than toward the whites. Anyway, it was at this stage in my life that I began to look upon Negro men as cowards. I could not respect them for smiling in a white man's face and addressing him as Mrs. So-and-so, saying yes sir and no sir, when after they went home behind closed doors, that same white man was a son of a bitch, a bastard, or any other name more suitable than this. At the intervals of work, the way in such cities as Baton Rouge and New Orleans, after finishing high school with a brilliant record in academics and athletics, she was able to go to college on scholarship. First in Natchez College, where we glimpse her further relations with the young, a maturing womanhood and her leadership. Then to Tupelo, where she was to make contact with liberal forces which had not been available to write. With NAACP work and organizations like SNCC, which provided her with the participation that could give her temporary resolution and contact with powerful local and outside forces unavailable. Here the blacks with older blacks in contact with older blacks and resisting whites continued to sharpen. Resistance in Mississippi to desegregation created a pattern of murder both in the areas of direct conflict in which she worked and in her hometown. Ann Moody becomes a veteran of police intimidation, sit-in beatings, and violent and frustrated marches. The masses of older blacks are gradually goaded into participation by the example of the young and by the weight of their outrage. When they sing, the older blacks sing, and hears the note of anguish as they sing freedom songs. Listening to those old Negroes sing freedom songs, I'm quoting, was like listening to music from heaven. They sang them as though they were singing away the chains. Sometimes I just look at the expression on their faces as they sang, and cold chills would run down my back. Whenever God was mentioned in a song, I could tell by the way they said the word that most of them had given up here on earth. They seemed to be waiting just for God to call them home and end all their suffering. Later she speaks of the older blacks as a lost cause. Although the book recalls the absoluteness of every kind of oppression, passion of her own commitment, and the pain she endures through strained relations with her own family, the guilt concerning the possibility that her activities are partly responsible for reprisal brutalities and murders in her own hometown, to make her insufficiently aware of what the simple gesture of registering to vote costs the older person. And Mrs. Chen explains to her one of the paradoxes. Although blacks outnumber whites now 3-1 in Madison County, Mississippi, and on 40% of the land, they were still paralyzed by the fact that the local level method of allotting the amount of land to be devoted to producing the cotton tax crop meant that the whites, backed up by the federal government, were allotted the most productive land. And by the fact that the black landowners were not the white families. The elaborate description and notations of various forms of violence and murders dramatized the fact that the fact balance to sustain the draws upon nonviolent emotion and resistance was overdrawn by the South and America. 5 black teenagers were shot, black girls were raped, 5 murders occurred in the area of Centerville, Woodville, and Milton alone. Medgar Evers was assassinated, a black boy may be permanently injured from vicious police beating. In Birmingham, 4 girls died in bombing of a black church. And President Kennedy, the symbol of young liberal America, is assassinated. At the March on Washington, we were expected to find leaders but found instead dreamers. The FBI stops outside the voter registration office, sends a message to Ann not to talk to them. Resent the fact that she forces them to come inside, ask questions, and this year not to be heard from again. And 2 FBI men sit in a car and watch while policemen unprovoked beat the boy McKinley Hamilton into senselessness on the street. Then ask the blacks, quote, what happened? Moody feels, even in the talks of the firm and discipline involved Moses, the hopelessness of the situation. He doubted Mrs. Chen, her husband driven out of business and now placed on the chain gang, has also absorbed that inequality of the situation. Thus, autobiography rises to the level of symbol of a terrifying moment in a history when a people's spiritual and cultural resources ran out of gas. The cry would soon come to forsake the moral excursion and to create something called Black Power. The history of Satan's passion has both positives and negatives. Ordinarily, one expects a clear distinction between the private confessional aspects and the public memoir making the political statement in Northern Ireland. In the Coming of Age, however, the personal and confessional have given aspects of the private life so fused with the public political statement that a division seems hardly reasonable. The autobiography begins with dire family conflicts. The mother rejected her first husband because of his attentions to other women. She, with three children, worked desperately for them. And then she meets her future husband, Raymond, by whom she has more children. There's conflict with Raymond's family because the mother is not high yellow. In other words, fall before she is able to persuade Raymond to marry her. Because to her mother and in revolt against her as a person who is child and poverty blasted and exploited, and begins to walk the road of rebellion. Her commitment to an achievement orientation in books, athletics, and extracurricular activities seem in part a reaction to both poverty and her mother's situation. To make matters worse, her stepfather Raymond becomes sexually attracted to her as she moves, as she becomes, and as she herself becomes an attractive teenager. A frustrated attraction, which she expresses so violently that Anne, with equal violence, leaves home. His portrait in the book is written and soaked in bitterness. This recoil from the sexual exploitation of her mother, who eventually produces a great number of children, seems to have something to do with Anne's survival of a response to the continuous adults in men up to the time of her joining the movement, civil rights movement, an act which takes place of further discussion of man-woman relations. At Natchez College, she reports, "I was 20 years old and I had never been kissed. Not even a smack on the lips. I wanted to know how it felt. Attracted to the 6'5" Kent, not Kent, and out of his pressure for a kiss, she got instructions from the girl to explain that all she had to do lips." Eventually, after contemplating the matter for a couple of months, she begins kissing with Kim. And, quote, "During the first 6 months of our relationship, I was happier than I had ever been. Kim turned me on so much that I made the first straight A average." That has been at Texas College in many years. I almost get an academic dean to point out that is a most unusual outcome for government.
I think that'll do it. That'll do it.
After that loss, she again slipped away from the group she has been associated with. She become again a loner. She was to tell that the way the man-woman relations on campus became, quote, everything. "I didn't want to get all wrapped up in the way some of the other girls did with their partners. My relation with him is gradually become a brother-sister thing. He could tell I was moving away from him, and he got himself a girl in the city. I wasn't even jealous, and I didn't say anything. I just didn't care. I knew I was leaving him behind next year, and figured he'd have somebody else. I pretended that I didn't know he had another girl, and went on being friends with him. He was the best friend I had had since Lola, and I told him everything, unquote. Lola was a homosexual who had taught her something about dressing. We may surmise, I think, that Anne's attraction to Kim was mainly an ego satisfaction and being able to take over the outstanding athlete, the man whom the girls thought was the greatest catch. In other words, this relationship was more related to validation of status than to basic attraction. The second relationship with Kikulu was a Dave Jones, who after a month of acquaintance was anxious to take her there. Anne felt she did not like him that much and told him that, quote, I was a virgin and I was afraid to be strung around on campus. Quote, he kept telling me that he would take care of me, that he would hurt me and all that shit. Getting on my back, I told him that I would, only when I felt that I was ready. After another month or so, and I still wasn't ready, he got mad. And one night in the car, he tried to take me. And so, for the time being, Moody Christian starts singing again after he becomes a civil rights hero, and after she has been brought low from race and family friction. Quote, by now I was so low, I needed someone's comfort. I started seeing Dave again, and the same old trouble started. But this time I didn't care so much. He would soon be out, and I would see him again. Dave would graduate if anyone did. He had even received the Woodrow Wilson Fellowship, unquote. After this comment upon Dave, Anne goes intensely into the nonviolent movement. And we hear little else about love affairs and her development in that direction. In the reading experience of the book, the change feels natural, the personal becoming a kind of irrelevancy. It is only upon repeated readings and reflection that the situation seems to be one of the unresolved tensions of the book. Second unresolved tension seems to be the relationship between Anne and her family, particularly with her mother. In her early life, her mother had been a high-spirited, joyful woman. Quote, she was slim, tall, and untawny skin, with high cheekbones and long, dark hair. She usually came out of the fields laughing, and Anne sensed that she and her husband Raymond were hooked on the land. Mom and Raymond had been hooked to the soil since they were children, and I got the feeling, especially from Mama, that they were now trying to hook me. Sometimes I'd help Mama over the garden, and she'd be telling me how she used to take so much time, and how she used to do this, and used to do that. Then she'd be pit-catting around in the soil, barefooted, bragging about the collard greens, and how old Mother Nature took care of him. Look at those mustard greens here. Something was nothing but a seed a few weeks ago. Now they're red leaves. She would kick up her foot into the soil and say, boy, you can put any kind of seed in this garden. Before you know it, you've got something to eat. That's why I think she was in her garden. And most of what she said was true. She did have the most beautiful garden I'd ever seen. The whole thing fascinated me, planting seeds, growing your own food, using the rain and the sun and the earth, and even the idea of making a living from it. But it was the hardest way I knew of making a living. The excitement of the mother was what Richard Wright calls in his short story, Fire and Cloud, a pose deriving from an organic relationship with nature. But he added that the white man had come between the black man's satisfaction and nature with the economic exploitation of the land. This seems to be what Anne is dimly thinking. And Anne rounds out her mother's lectures on farming with the story she got this Clyburn concerning the traveling this Clyburn barn, the white Mrs. Clyburn had done, and the people she had met. Mrs. Clyburn had told Anne how smart Anne was, what she could do if she had a chance. American dream about. The farm forces a dead end. If Raymond hadn't planted corn in these fields, the love of God hadn't been so good, we would have starved to death that winter. But Anne remained involved with her mother at a certain night during high school exercises. She wishes for her mother's presence. Her mother's ideas are simple. She would like Anne to get married to Hicks, the high school coach and basketball team. She wants her to avoid irritating white people and to stay away from sexual parts in high school programs. The support of Anne in college is unstated, almost non-existent, because of the hostility of her husband Raymond. Still, Anne wishes to have understanding from the family and to be a triumph for her. But activities in the civil rights movement only sharpen their fears and put them in triumph for her. But activities in the civil rights movement only sharpen their fears and send them into a survival motion, the family does, of claiming before the white authorities that Anne has almost cut her ties with the family. Anne feels pride in finally becoming first of the family to graduate from college, but nobody from the family is there when she graduates. Her sister Adeline manages some complications by the fact that Adeline spent the money for a dress, which would have paid her travel expenses, for Anne's dress, which would have paid her travel expenses from graduation. Anne's birthday comes, and she's comforted by strangers. When she does see her mother, the mother has another baby, and it's hurt because Anne is slow in paying attention to it. Such conflict spread their way through the movement episodes. The grandmother Winnie, after Anne gains notoriety in the civil rights movement, refuses to give Anne hospitality. The grandmother is a woman who has borne the ravages of the plantation tradition, having had 13 children out of wedlock and having seen only one married. The two whom she hoped most for had disappointed her. She had given her other children away one by one for adoption in the free will plantation, and her whole life of hardship seemed evident upon her face. Quote, I got the feeling we were thinking about many things. For 20-some years on the plantation, 13 children and no husband, and always with hope for something better. But now she ended up in Maple Hill Restaurant, washing dishes, sharing the kitchen with two cursing cooks, and a bunch of strange men who thought they were women. So much, homosexual. So much for those unstable glimmerings of the American dream, and thus the sources of unresolved personal tensions unite with the driving necessity to do something different from those accepting so much of life as acceptable. Still a curious irony emerges, which is central to the book. The civil rights movement acted out its reach for a new day through the simple songs and rights provided by the older people. You see, the marching, the fellowshipping. In doing so, the younger people and the movement in general made dramatic improvements in the social fabric, but also came to a knowledge already held by the old that black servitude and oppression resulted from an inexorable machine made up of many parts, the connivance of the state and federal governments, and even local counties, the subversion of all institutional documents, such as constitutions, economics, and recovery, the triumphant march on Washington in the face of such a machine threatened to become merely a one-day masquerade. But the notorious bombing which killed the poor black girl in the Birmingham church, the reality. From exaltation provided by comradeship and glimmers of hope, and becomes increasingly the shell-shocked warrior victim. In a long passage, she pronounces the irrelevance of God and the death of the nonviolent movement. With the assassination of President Kennedy, the shell-shocked condition becomes controlled, as well it temporarily might, for he has symbolized, however unstable, the liberal American dream possibilities, which the emotional and spiritual reservoir of blacks had joined to its cultural system of resistance. At the end, almost like an automaton, stuck with built-in patterns by which it moves, and is again on the way to Washington, as one youth puts it, to quote, tell something. As the youth tries to start the group in song, and looks at him and feels very old. The truth will make us free. The truth will make us free. The truth will make us free someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe the truth will make us free someday. 12-year-old Gene stopped the singing and said, Moody, we're going to get things straight. Watch. I didn't ask him. I knew I didn't have to. He looked as if he knew exactly what I was thinking. I wonder. We shall overcome someday. I wonder again. I really wonder. My ancestors have also wondered and would have understood. Thus one wishes that she could have somehow broken through the fault, but warned not to the style that she and those who were to begin the next period of struggle, could have grasped more of the inner symbols from what Sterling Brown called Strange Legacies, in a poem by that name, Strange Legacies from the grass might have given them a power, when us a power, lost by the assumption that rebirth is possible through ahistorical rhythms. The birth ex nihilo, so tempting and false to many of the young of any group and of any generation. What the autobiography does do is to register through a powerful rebel that moment in a people's history when a new abolition movement, as I've said, as an entity, ran out of gas, and a new refueling at the beginning. Its effectiveness in doing so, the autobiography's effectiveness in doing so, gives it its special place in autobiography. They felt that they loved getting something that was no longer touched. relations with my daughter. The only thing I can make is a thank you. I think that the spiritual continuity becomes much more possible. That's not it.
Yes.
John,
I have two. One, words that you use. And I also kind of might have been misreading the implications there. One was your use of on, so you said hooked on. Maybe that's two words I'm talking about. You thought that she saw her parents hooked on.
Yeah.
Saw.
Oh.
Rather than, I guess I would have thought hooked upon or hooked back. And I wanted to put that hooked on in. In your words. And the other was in the free way of plantation, and I'm questioning T-H-E, the free way, is it,
okay.
I wonder if I'm getting...
All right, well, let me start one at a time.
Okay.
Number one, very briefly on that. I meant the phrase to carry what I thought Anne meant to carry, a sense of being dope.
Yeah.
Okay. The combination of words is right or not.
Yeah.
I meant to carry the sense of...
Just the context is so different from what you're saying.
And kind of dim insight, there was something to it. Because that was, for her, a disaster. Here. Does that answer that part of your question?
Yes, sir.
I like men and plan to do so as long as I can. So what I was going to say derives not from any feminine hostility, but from what I perceive as an honest lack. This lack is in the manner in which black male authors depict the black woman. I'm sorry to say that in all the black American literature I have read by men, and I have not, of course, read all of it here, I have found few examples of a black woman portrayed in all her complexity. Indeed, there are all too few instances of her being portrayed realistically at all. Mainly, I found the image of a black woman to fall within certain clearly defined categories. As a result, the women are one-dimensional, and usually that dimension is one that is in no way threatening to the men. Generally speaking, the black woman created in the mind of male artists tends to be either the mother type or the whore. There are many variations of these types. For example, the bitchy wife who holds her sensitive artist husband to materialistic values. The woman whose function is to protect and take care of others is generically a mother. Even the best of our writers are guilty of this oversimplification. A few are sympathetic, most, unfortunately, are not. Richard Wright, whose genius is for me a source of wonder and inspiration, has created a bevy of strange men. A few mother types are supernatural in their strength. Aunt Susie. Most are pitiful, defeated, blind, and poor. Few are well defined. Ralph Ellison has no black women at all in his novel, except the motherly mirror. And none stand out in his story. Imamu Amiri Baraka's black women are symbols rather than people, and often rather peculiar symbols. The daddy is a whore with the most repulsive nature, symbolizing usually our people seeking after white balance. The few goodies are super beautiful young mother types. Help me to the black heroes who are a real sense of Ernest J. James creates the positive mother type. For example, Miss Jane Pittman and the mother in the sky is gray. But seldom does he show the black woman in the full range of her role. And so it goes with him right along the line. The very lowest point is probably John A. Gilbert. Black women are almost without exception materialistic, selfish, even ruthless whores whose influence on the sensitive black people is entirely destructive. This is not to say that no male writer has ever created a rounded, realistic black woman character. Surely they must be fine. And I do not doubt that you will force them out to me later. But by and large, the portrait of us, painted by our most artistic students, is damaged. We need to think about this long and seriously. I believe that this is symptomatic of a profound problem which lies deep in our psyche, and which prevents us from looking at each other courageously and with love. This possibility needs to be examined much more thoroughly than I am here able to do. Moreover, a delicate question arises. Is there any relationship between the negative image of black women and the fact that so many of our most vocal writers are married to white women? This question is a hot potato.
You're showing me.
And I really do. I need to be looked at. Let me assert emphatically that I am not here taking any stand against the humanity. Okay? Nor am I attacking any particular matter. But I do believe, honestly, that art emerges from the wellspring of our being. And I am compelled to wonder to what extent this distorted or incomplete image of a black woman represents the black male writer's rationalization for his mating preference. It's been left to the woman writer to portray the black woman in dress and in full range of her success. Jane and Laura Neale Hurston, their eyes are like and love on both campus, live and breathe. Urge and endure, commits an act unspeakable in its heart, but beautiful in its selfishness, emerges damaged but with a full sense of beauty and humanity. Mary Evans, in her poetry, lays bare the sensitivity of a woman, honed to the exquisite sharpness by her history. Mary makes us feel the strength, the joy, the despair, the longing, and the triumph. Then she sums it all up in a powerful poem. I am a black woman. Paul Marshall, whom I believe to be the most talented black novelist of our time, gives us a panorama of well-defined women in all their weakness and strength and foolishness and wisdom, serene. The grandmother, Dada, Rena, the strange and unforgettable Merle, and most of all, the transplanted Beijing Scylla. Scylla, the sharp tongue and ready vengeance. Scylla, the suppressed passion and infinite longing. Scylla, whose strength both creates and destroys. Yes, it has been the women writers who have sung our song to the world. And there are so many others. I had to cut it short somewhere, but I was thinking of so many other women. I was thinking of Tony Page on Baron Gable, who was kind of inspiration to me. Honey, I wish I could be as tough and as tender as he was. Right to me. And I'm just all kinds of other women, but you know, you have to say that. I would like now to examine a bit more closely the way in which one woman has shown us the variegated dimensions of black womanhood and has used her own femininity as a window through which she may view our world. I'm talking about Gwendolyn Brooks. Gwen Brooks' poetry is like fine silk, natural, soft, smooth, rich, infinitely strong and feminine. When you consider her work in terms of, you're wonderfully aware of the womanliness that shines through. That is one of the beauties of her work and one of the reasons for our loving response. But womanliness for this poetry is not a mere jewel to be kept, not a mere decoration. It is the fiber of the work, the strong silken thread that creates the pattern of ideas. I want to pursue two such patterns, very, very briefly. First, the portrayal of the many aspects of womanhood. And secondly, the use of a woman's experiences to achieve a view of deepest human truth. And since Wayne is a black poet, whose work flows from black experience, then it is black womanhood that we're talking about. When Brooks' poetry is viewed as a whole, explores many different facets of womanhood. Relationships with men, with children, and with the world. A woman's inner world as well as the world's external reality. These are the stuff of a great many poems. Talk first about relationships with men. Now here, I don't mean what is generally referred to as romantic love, which is a pallid, fragile thing. Nor am I talking about the biological detail of sex, which details have a way of becoming remarkably unprivate and result in a certain titillation, you might say, but seldom result in a profoundly moving artistic experience. Now, Gwendolyn Brooks' poems about men and women go far below the surface and delve into the depths of what men and women mean to each other. The relationships are generally, though not always, uncompromised for this particular book. Incomplete ones, underscoring the difficulty of real togetherness between man and woman, male and female, in this difficult world, especially in the complex world of blackness. Talk with Mabby, for example. A lovely, dark brown little girl of seven has a crush on Willie Boone, waiting for him after school, anticipating mutual 7-year-old girl. But Willie comes out of school proudly flaunting a light-skinned girl. And Maddie's whole self-concept, whole view of the world changes. The poem ends with a note of terrible aloneness as foreboding. With Mabby alone by the grammar school gate, yet chocolate companion. Mabby on Mabby with touches of her heart. Mabby on Mabby. The theme of the black girl losing out is repeated with heavy irony and doubt of Pearl May Lee. When Pearl berates her lynched lover for his preference for white girls. As she says, you paid for your dinner, Sandy boy, and you didn't pay with money. You paid with your hide in my heart, Sandy boy, for your piece of peace and quiet time. The same thing occurs in the living of a song. Even when love is happy, often the happiness is tenuous and temporary. When You Have Forgotten Sunday is a warm, rich poem of the little ordinary Sunday things that husbands and wives do. The gentle, loving little things, like sitting on a radiator and chatting about nothing in particular, and having dinner on an ink-spotted table in front of their camp. The poem describes, quote, how we finally undressed and whipped out the light and flowed into bed and lay loose them for a moment in the weekend bright bed clothes, then gently folded into one another. But there's a kind of sadness about the poem, for it says, when you have forgotten Sunday. So not if you have forgotten, if you will ever forget, but when you have forgotten. And it can be sadly, then I may be husband and wife is in the Ballad of Rudolph Reed, in which the husband and wife are described as open. But this very unity is the instrument of destruction. When the Reeds moved into a white neighborhood, their new neighbors bombard them with rocks. And when their child is cut by flying glass, Rudolph, enraged, takes gun and knife and injures poor white man that is killed. The time for peace and love seems to be the end of life. 2 points, Old Marriage and the Bean Eater, are unforgettable portraits of elderly couples. After the seasons of life have ended, sharing memories and sharing beans. Someone says, they eat beans mostly with old young hair. Dinner is a casual affair, plain chipware on plain cooking wood, thin flatware. Two who are mostly here. Two who have lived their day but keep on putting on their clothes and putting things away. And remember. Remembering the twinklings and twinges as they lean over the beans in their rented back room that is full of beans and receipts and balls and cloths and battered drums, vases, and singles. Plus, it's just a nice kind of picture of the relationship between old married couples. Other relationships are important to women. And Gwen Brooks, of course, exposed many of them. I'm particularly moved by the poem in which children are central, either in a real or in a symbolic sense. Children, the cook, the mother, and other poems plunge deep into mother feelings, but go beyond these feelings in their symbolic value. In more recent years, a series of poems on the Blackstone Ranges reveals an almost caressive concern and affection for teenage street youngsters, a concern and affection easily translatable into the need for unity and mutual help among the generations of black people. Women dream, and often these dreams must skirt around harsh reality. This is especially true for black women. Some of Gwen's poems portray so poignantly the persistence of dreams, aspirations, in spite of life's hardships. Beauty Shop, for example, tells of the change which the customer hopes expects will be there. And in the series, Hattie Scott, a domestic worker, strong and indomitable, wrings the last treasures out of her life and somehow retains her down-to-earth dreams of Little China. Perhaps the loveliest expression of persistence of dreams and hope is in Kitchen at Building, in which the speaker wonders whether dreams can really survive the dull reality of poverty and near poverty, and then settle for a very small, very real, and very important place. That poem goes like this. We have things of dry hours and the involuntary plain, braiding and gray, dreams, with a giddy sound, not strong like this, creating a life, satisfying a man. But could a dream send up through onion seams with white and violet, fight with fried potatoes and yesterday's garbage right in the wall? Flutter or sing an aria down these rooms, even with evil rooms that it did. Had time to warm it, keep it very clean, anticipate a message, let it begin. Too wonder, but not well, not for a minute. Since number 5 is out of the bathroom now, we think of lukewarm water. Hope to get in. Some of Gwen's poems are quick, compassionate glimpses of women. Ordinary women, little people, often women unlovely to the tangible glance, but having a tremendous warm humor and dignity. Southeast Corner speaks sympathetically of a beautician dead now, whose pool of beauty is now a tavern, and comments simply but eloquently on the transience of life, the transience of beauty. Hunchback Girl thinks of heaven, she thinks of heaven, tells of the girl's alienation because of her handicap, and her hope that in heaven, I shall walk straightly through most proper halls, proper myself, princess of property. Queen of the Blues tells the loneliness of a sexy blues singer who has no one to care whether she is mistreated. The rightful cousin Dick pictures a woman too alive to be a corpse in a cold, stagnant passage. A woman who has enjoyed the things of this world, drinking, lovemaking, gossiping, and who somehow feels ill. One of my favorite compassionate pictures of little people was the Hattie Scott series about the undefeatable domestic worker. There is something in Hattie which defies the slings and arrows about Bridget's fortune. Somehow Hattie manages to make it. At the hairdresser, for example, Hattie has a lot to say about it. You know, this is going to look like it's going to get finished with it. How grand she can be. Okay, now I've been talking about the short film. There are three longer works in which Glenn gives in-depth treatment to the life of a woman. Annie Allen is a biographical work which portrays the emotional experiences of a woman from birth to maturity. The Annie Air section in particular probes the psyche of this young woman. Second work is the lovely poetic novel, Nora Martha, which gives vignettes of a woman's life, her little girlhood, her relationship with her family, her first boyfriend, her marriage, the fact of her black. And the little incidents which in everyone's life are the turning point to development. The third work is Gwen's autobiography, which is a full flowering of all the earlier work, a study of this remarkable woman who is somehow a symbol of all black women. Through a woman's sensibility, when the book shows us